We're outside today for the Church of the Subgenius, bearing the cold weather. Before I switch to our location mic from Bob, I just want to run through quickly what we played. And a very unusual, distorted version of Amazing Grace, John Rose, formerly of Australia, now in Amsterdam. It's time to bring the mic up. Bring the microphone up.
Thank you, Mike.
Welcome back, and hope you don't mind us coming outside today for this show. I just found a nice quiet spot.
It's not cold.
Subgenius?
That's
very good, Mike. That's for Subgenia is not cold. We have totally yogic control of our autonomic systems.
Well, it's 5:31. Do you want to go right into correspondence course number two today? Or do you want to do that after the
No, I'll go into it now.
Okay.
I'll start it off, unless you want to bring up something. Anything
I can
mind?
Bring it up after.
Okay, you got something for later?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll concentrate on this now. This is part two of Bob Dobbs' correspondence course. We featured some bottom-up analysis last week, illustrating the effects. Yeah, I could have said effects, but effects. I said that's effect and fact together, right? The effects of the 10 thunders of Finnegan's Wake. I'm going to do a little top-down analysis and describe how we got to this and the forces behind the prison of pink we're in today, which then leads into the Secret Council of Ten and my role in that situation. So this is the first. It's correspondence course number two, but part one of top-down analysis explaining the Secret Council of Ten. So I'll begin with these statements. From his grave, the great tragedian, or subgenius, Aeschylus, you know, the Greek one, is laughing today, while the chief character of his most famous drama, Prometheus, nods agreement with the subgenius tradition and with Bob's efforts, because seeing the way in which official Pink Washington reacted to Pink Monday, Aeschylus and Prometheus would say, and they are saying it right now, so do the mighty pink gods of Olympus fall, as the price of their long defiance of the Bob, or creator. You see, the Secret Council 10 is based around an international concert of very wealthy pink families, which are the most powerful component of the ruling U.S. liberal establishment. And conservative establishment, the establishment. They are the most powerful component of that pink prison. These include the royal and aristocratic families of Europe. They also include untitled sorts of noble financier families in the USA and Europe, modeled upon the noble families of Venice. And that's why we get to the Council of Ten, because the Council of Ten was the secret government of Venice for many centuries up till the 1800s. Now, the biological members of these pink aristocratic families play less and less a policy-shaping role in the destiny of nations. The effective power of these pinks and their subsequent pink prism lies less with vast interlocking financial corporations, such as family trusts and foundations, which themselves are all modeled upon the Venetian institution known as the Fondo, or in plural forms, the Fondi. That is the pink trust, the family trust. Now, the effective power is less lying with that institution. These fondi are administered by a combination of elite pink law firms, and financial management organizations. The leading figures in such legal and management enterprises are the ones who actually shape the policies of the family's fondi, or the family's trust funds. Let's go back centuries. They shape the policies of where the money goes. The hierarchy of pink power is organized in financier syndicates, for which the vastly powerful reinsurance cartels of Venice are the topmost ranking power today. All right? You got that? The reinsurance cartels. The power runs through lesser but vastly powerful reinsurance cartels. And so the power is passed top-down through lesser but vastly powerful reinsurance pink cartels. Under all normal conditions, these reinsurance cartels take no capital risk and therefore enjoy an infinite rate of return on their net operating and capital gains incomes. All right, I hope you're writing this down or taping it, because these are sentences that should be perused over and over again. Due to time constrictions, I have to move on. Below these reinsurance cartels lie the ordinary major banking cartels, coordinated through powerful investment banking institutions. Hence, there is a monopoly on world trade in and prices of food run chiefly through Switzerland, as only one branch operation of this complex of pink fondue. For the past 30-odd years, which is the time that Bob has really moved into these areas, all right, since World War II, and in the early 50s, this food cartel has run the U.S. Department of Agriculture, for example, as it does under such accomplices of Cargill Corporation, Armin Hammer, and Dwayne Andreas, as Secretary Richard Lynn today. Let me read that again, or restate it. Okay, this cartel has run the U.S. Department of Agriculture as Secretary Richard Lynn does today, as it was done by Cargill, Armin Hammer, and Dwayne Andreas. Of course, the biological heirs of these pink fondue trusts are highly mortal and have become more mortal than usual since the AIDS epidemic discovered the sexual practices common among the international chic pink set. All right, I'm not commenting in value judgment, I'm just clinically stating the facts. The personality of the families themselves lies in the corporate form of the family's existence. In other words, the personality is the fondue-like institutions. And it is these pink fondue, juridically the Roman-style paterfamilias of the family, which is the true personality of the family as a power. And it is the managers of the fondue's interests who are the center of power. Now, the corporate form of these families is an aristocratic ruling class sitting above the governments of Western Europe and the Americas. As a class, it is a distinct social species. Now, we're talking about the genetic roots of pinkdom. Now, 2/3 of the world population are, as a result of this infection, pink. All right? But we're talking about the origins of pinkdom. But except in matters it sees as representing the vital interests of its social class of species as a whole, it is often divided in its policies. The various members of these fondi. The various factions and families within the class tear and bite one another routinely, with theft and murder commonplaces of interfamily dealings. Now, as Bob, I've seen this and been part of it. In these and related aspects, this social class is a real-life imitation of the mythical gods of Olympus, the original pink gods, hence beginning with the comment from Aeschylus and Prometheus. Contrary to the socialist propagandas, well, we'll say that contrary to the pink socialists, right? There are subgenius socialists. This is not a capitalist class. It is traced directly to the ruling social class of ancient Mesopotamia, much as it might surprise you. It is traced back that far, 3000 BC, the social class against which the American subgenius revolution was fought. The system of political economy which this social class has sought to impose and defend since the ancient Chaldeans and Phoenicians is based on a system of usury first known to have been established in ancient Mesopotamia and Phoenicia. Now, Mike, what are we at? What's 5:38?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Bob does not need a watch.
Yeah. All right. Now, give me another minute, and then we'll go into the tape.
All right.
Okay. To continue here, this system is based on usury. It divides society between ordinary people, ordinary pinks, and ordinary subgeniuses, as subject nations and individuals destined to pay usury to the fondue-like family class, and the ruling aristocrats, and Tyre-like, the biblical Tyre, and Venice-like financier nobles, who collect the proceeds of usury in such forms as ground rent, this is important, ground rent, speculative profits on trading monopolies in raw materials, and financial usury. As ground rent, speculative profits on trading monopolies in raw materials and financial usury. The system of usury is not only an economic relationship between the ruling class and the ruled, it is also a social and a political relationship with pink designs. And I think that's enough for bombastic, cathartic and didactic information. Let's go to the relief of the phony and false slack-inducing tape of Reverend Stang and Philo Drummond. This tape is called Slack. And note, as you listen to this for the next 15 or so minutes, the slack will disappear from you. But you can maintain a private ounce of slack because, you know, Mike and I will be back by 5 to 6.
Side one of this tape, slack.
And now I've got more sense. Now I've got my job. Job to save me. He showed me slack. Slack, being able to edit your own memory and cut your attention span down to just 3 little minutes. You can program your life just like that TV guy.
We're going to have to draw it to an end. Some pretty heavy survival stuff going on there. Not bad. That was the Pope David Myers, I think, wasn't it?
What? What was that?
I don't know. Did you hear something?
Jeez. Okay. Yeah, that was good outtakes from meetings and conferences, panel discussions, symposia that I was at. So that's why it's good. That was a not bad tape. Not too much interference by Stang and Drummond until the end when they quoted from the book, which was ridiculous. I mean, you know, the book is an unedited volume of vomit and crap.
What was that one line in there? All your religion asks of you is that you do not think. Is that, without paraphrasing? But
it's good enough.
Yeah,
it's
close.
It's sort of important.
So what are your feelings on that, on your ability not to think? Not yours, of course, but the subgenius. Yeah. Does that apply to the subgenius or to those?
No, there's no ground given there. I mean, what I mean is that statement is a figure without the ground. Now, traditionally, as we move through a visual space culture of the last 2,000 years, the right hemisphere, preliterate acoustic, that's right hemisphere of the brain, which has an acoustic bias, was revived as archetypal intensity. Therefore, you have a de-emphasis on logic and left hemisphere activity, right? And that kind of intuitive religious experience based on faith is right hemisphere. The problem is that was okay as a revival in archetypal intensity for the last 2,000 years, but now that we've returned into acoustic space, therefore, right hemisphere is natural and pinkish. It's a given. We're all being conditioned. The right hemisphere has been propped back up as the left hemisphere submerges, all right? So to be comprehensive, you have to use both hemispheres and have a dialogue with your corpus callosum, that part of the brain that's between the left and right hemisphere. So you have here, I think that was Pope Meyer. Was that Pope Meyer of New York? Or Drummond. But they're quoting the values of faith and putting down going into right hemisphere action via the mind or logic. Now, that is totally inappropriate to our time. The point is, how do you get slack? Not in those terms. How do you get comprehensive process pattern recognition? You have to use all your faculties and senses and wits and know the ground. Now, the only plus you can give to Meyer there is that he's using a public address system. Now, it's good to hoik up right hemisphere values to an electric public address system. All right, because you're merging with the effect of the address system anyways. The address system will create an acoustic space and a right hemisphere dominance. But that is not offering comprehensive awareness for all situations which we are immediately in contact with under our discarnate situation. All right? So that's just a mere platitude. It's a pink platitude coming across. It has a bit of charm because it's in the proper environment, and I was there. But I wouldn't have used that on any tape I put out.
No, no.
You know, this is the tape I'm putting out where I edit and explain.
Yeah. Yeah. What about, I heard also something in this particular subgenius tape referring to the man on the stick smoking Chesterfields.
That's true.
Again, is it true?
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Well, of course.
You would know that answer, and I...
Only I would know, of course. Well, yeah. How do you think Jesus got the Chesterfields?
Well, some sort of black market, I can
that's right. That's what I had to do during the Roman Pink Empire, is I was operating an extensive cigarette black market, which was mostly used in the monasteries in the Himalayas and the Sufi monasteries and the North American Indian monasteries. And, of course, Jesus, having passed through those zones on his way to his public ministry, picked up a few cigarettes. And that's how he got them, from me.
Here in Canada, we're not really known for our thinkers. We have had some great thinkers and idea makers over the years. Did any Marshall McLuhan mean anything to you?
I was Marshall McLuhan. I mean, you know, the thing is, this is the thing about Canada. It has a low national identity. And under electric conditions and TV effects in the 60s, it was appropriate to have a low national performance. Actually, you do dialogue, since Canada was a borderline case, many borderlines in Canada. Under electric conditions of the global electric theater, we were interfacing with all cultures, so the figure of Trudeau surfaced as a man. In right-wing terms, he's an internationalist, you know, or he didn't do enough for the nationalist wobblies or whatever was functioning in Canada at that time. The thing is, he was playing the appropriate role, merging as a solitary outlaw with the role of Canada's a low nationalist identity profile, which is appropriate in the 60s. Now, the problem is the electric conditions have flipped into a return to visual values in the 80s. That's the Reaganomics and Mulroneyism and all these things propping up national identity. Now's the time to prop up the Canadian heritage as a rearview mirror response and celebrate our heroes, intellectual heroes. We only had one, and that was me. And he didn't know I was me in the 60s as Marshall McLuhan, but in the 80s, it's appropriate to know me literally as now, as Bob, as what I was and what Canada is, because we are bringing back as nostalgia Canada's identity. Do you know what I mean? Because we've moved into an isolationist thing in this global Africa, the Africa within, rather, to quote Joseph Conrad. Visual values have surfaced all around the world in terms of reaffirmation of your national heritage as a form of roots phenomenon, like the isolationist mood in America, all right? Now, this contrasts with the whole actual physical reality of mixed-media corporate environments on this tiny, tiny planet, right? But the values have resurfaced as a result of the flip of the TV environment into the opposite, which is left hemisphere values, visual values, only as values. Therefore, it's appropriate that I surface as the archetype of the Canadian identity now because I was behind it. But we're having a bit of trouble with this, I mean, in responding to my mandate, because the Canadian people are not used to waking up themselves as a nation, because they traditionally never were a nation. They were originally, when they became a nation, they're the only nation in history that was a nation, and then became a colony, and then became a nation again. All right? And then they became nothing in the 60s. Okay? But that was an appropriate role, to be nothing, and that was Trudeau's charisma. But that doesn't work today, hence the downfall of Trudeau and his image. Not himself personally, but his image, right? So Mulroney is trying to balance between what Trudeau was and with media magic and with Reagan, and he can't do it.
No, he can't do it at all.
And he's expressing the Canadian drama. That's why you have to take someone like me who's not really a Canadian to be a Canadian, to be the proper, balanced, comprehensive image for Canada.
It takes someone like you being a universal soldier to balance this, create this image that we all look for.
Which is an 80s phenomenon, a mixed image of right and left hemisphere values.
It's 6:02.
Oh, my God.
It's all right, Tom. Yeah. Christine's not here live, so it's okay. So,
does that answer you?
It does. I think maybe we'll touch upon this a bit next week. Are we going to have more,
this tape?
More,
courses?
Courses, I'm sorry.
Maybe. You just have to keep listening, and you can't miss a course, so you have to listen whether or not there's going to be school or not.
Let's do our sign-off then. My name is Mike Dyer. I'm a dupe. You are listening to The Church of the Subgenius, the last half hour of my show every Wednesday between 5:30 and 6. This is CKLN 88.1, and you, sir, are...
J.R. Bob Dobbs, important for the return of the Exus from the planet X, and you need me and the Secret Council 10 to orchestrate the Praise Bob Universal Slack, which will come about at that point.
And indeed, Praise Bob.
Mercy.